Court of Appeals. We have two cases on our docket this afternoon for oral submission. Understand counsel are ready and have announced the time that they would like to argue. With that being done, our clerk will call the first case.
The court will now call Texas Voices for Reason and Justice Incorporated versus the City of Argyle, Texas, the City of Hickory Creek, Texas, the City of Oakville, Texas, and the City of Parker. That this court, Mr. Richard Blatton will argue for the appellant, Mr. Matthew Clark will argue for the appellant, the town of Argyle, and town of Ponder.
Thank you. You may proceed.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. This case is on appeal from an order denying my client, Texas Voices, their motion for a Rule 76A, subsection 5, under the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure, a request for a sealing order and then ancillary relief in the form of a protective order that would limit the disclosure of the identifying information of witnesses or interested parties that aren't actually parties but would be witnesses under an associational standing doctrine claim made by Texas Voices, which is an entity. Incorporated partnership, or incorporated association. Before moving forward, I would note that most, if not substantially all, of the brief of the appellees is directed towards whether the trial court did or did not err in denying a plea to jurisdiction. In fact, the plea to jurisdiction was never addressed by the trial court. And it's actually my appeal from the denial of the protective order and sealing order that was requested. And for that reason, we have not briefed or responded to those parts of my opposing counsel's brief concerning whether this court ab initio should go ahead and act as if it were a trial court and consider the merits of the pleas to jurisdiction for each of the defendant cities. As I say, the motion that we filed seeking relief was filed pursuant to Texas Rules of Civil Procedure 76A, subsection 5. Contrary to the state's argument, that is a temporary order proceeding. And I think it was intended, I think it's pretty clear from the text of that rule, that it was intended to apply in circumstances where the 14-day notice requirement and public notice requirements would otherwise be required for a permanent sealing order. For that reason, those procedural requirements do not apply to subsection 5. That's our position. We think it's pretty clear from the text of the rule. And our first issue, we do claim that the trial court erred in denying our motion for those forms of relief. Number one, because we did identify a special interest that would be harmed irreparably, or actually would be harmed, and then the circumstances, that is the time frame involved in the trial court actually recognized in the quoted passage I have in my brief, that it understood because of the time frame there had not been sufficient time to allow me on behalf of my client to fulfill or satisfy all the procedural requirements that would be necessary for a permanent sealing order. That includes posting notice with the Texas Supreme Court, delivering notice to the Texas Supreme Court, posting a public notice where county notices are generally posted, things of that nature. In addition to that, unlike a burden of proof for the standards that would apply to a permanent sealing order request, a temporary order or a request for a temporary order does not have the same weighing of interest, obviously because the public at large has not been given notice. The rule, subsection 5, does not contemplate a weighing of the public interest when it's considering granting some interim or temporary relief until public notice can be posted and a hearing on the permanent relief is considered by a trial court. Again, we did specify what the interests were. We presented two witnesses that testified about the fact that it was kind of well-known in the community of registrants who, on behalf of whom my organization is suing, that it's not just, but all of them are required to register as sex offenders. We don't dispute that. But there's, our contention is that there's a difference between being on a public registry and being identified likely in the public media as someone who is an advocate or assisting or supporting in a much larger degree litigation to defend their rights. I mentioned in the affidavit attached to the motion the fact that during this period of time, because this was one of several lawsuits that were filed in different parts of Texas involving general law cities, that a Dallas radio station, talk radio station, spent not only all day in the morning but all day in the afternoon hurling abusive comments directed at me towards the people that would be witnesses who would benefit, that is registrants, and things of that nature. And it's a call-in show, so there's, you might guess there's a lot of not necessarily imminent threats, but comments that certainly concern my witnesses. I think that's exactly the situation in which a witness particularly should be entitled, or a party should be entitled, to disclose the identity to opposing counsel in a way that would in no way diminish their ability to conduct discovery through depositions or interrogatories. The only thing that we're asking is that they not, that they be restricted from publicly disclosing the personal identities of our witnesses in a way that would present them with a very credible and real concern about their safety of their families, themselves, their property, etc. The district court denied it. I think the primary fundamental problem with the district court's ruling is that it was of the belief that under Rule 76A5, a plaintiff, by filing a lawsuit, pretty much abandons or waives its right to relief under Rule 76A5. The article written by Justice Lloyd Doggett, I think, makes clear, as well as the other academic authorities that I've researched and found and cited in my brief, that this, the few courts that have adopted or been persuaded by an assertion of this plaintiff waiver rule are just in error. And that, in fact, I even cite the one case that was reversed, one U.S. district court, and what later became Smith versus Doe, had dismissed the plaintiff's case on the ground that they would not disclose their true identities. They were attempting to proceed under pseudonyms. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit reversed that decision and did kind of a balancing of interests and said that a litigant's claims challenging governmental authority generally does outweigh any public interest so long as it does not interfere with discovery of the opposing party. I've cited that in there. That case later became Smith versus Doe in the U.S. Supreme Court. The parties in that case were people who were required to register under an Alaska statute, and again, they were permitted to proceed under pseudonyms. The trial court did not, in fact, in the quoted passage I have in my brief, acknowledged that, contrary to my opposing counsel's statements, there was a problem in urgency because we had the plea of jurisdiction set 10 days later, roughly, and that there was no way that I could post notice 14 days before a permanent or before a hearing on a permanent order could be had. And so that sums up pretty much what our position is. I don't think that someone, in order to show an entitlement or otherwise to a protective order or a sealing order, should have to show more than a real substantial fear of abuse if their identities weren't, or if a protective order wasn't granted that shielded their identities. The opposing counsel seems to think that someone should actually have to have been assaulted or physically abused or had their property personally destroyed before they could have a reasonable apprehension of harm. We don't agree with that. And then finally, even were the court to reverse the trial court, or actually affirm the trial court's decision in this case, the process thereafter would result, I think, would be limited to remanding to the trial court. And I'd have to talk to my witnesses and either be able to persuade them to take the risk that they are concerned with, or dismiss any claim that was not supported by those witnesses' testimony. It's pretty commonplace. In fact, this court's own website requires attorneys who file information about parties or non-parties, if it's sensitive material, to redact that information. I had this same issue come up in Travis County in a similar case of this that was filed down there. And what the remedy of the trial court, district court, was there was just saying, I don't need to know the identities of these people. You can use pseudonyms, and it, with regard to a standing issue. But y'all, if you can agree to it, you and your opposing counsel, you can disclose to them who they were, and if they'll agree to protective order, then we can go that way. And that's what we ended up doing. In this case, what we're dealing with is defendant counsel who are using the fear, reasonable fears of my clients, as leverage to force the dismissal of my claims. I don't think that's the purpose of the rules. There's no reason they could not agree to a protective order where they'd know the address, know the names, take the deposition of my witnesses, and then we could assign or agree, like we have in Travis County, to give them initials or some other pseudonym so each side would know who we are talking about. Their unwillingness to enter into that agreement can be justified by no other reason than a tactical advantage to compel either placing my witnesses in harm or reasonable apprehension of harm or cause the dismissal of my claims. And I just don't think the rules permit that. And I do think, contrary to the district court, that this rule applies equally to both defendant parties as well as plaintiff parties. If the rulemakers would intend it to only apply to defendants, they could have said so, but they didn't. And that's pretty much all I have, unless the court has additional questions.
Help me with the distinction you just closed with, Mr. Gladden. Look, I'm not aware of any court ruling or any finding in any court case that I've read in my 51 years of practice that tries to differentiate on how the rules apply as to whether you're a plaintiff or a defendant. I mean, all the rules apply equally to plaintiffs and defendants. So how does that affect the court's ruling in this case that you're appealing?
Okay. In this case, another quoted passage that we have set out in the brief makes clear that the district court was under the mistaken assumption that there is such thing as what's called a waiver justification rule, that a very small minority of courts in state courts and other parts of the country have adopted, wherein they say that even though this rule is applies equally to both sides, if it's the plaintiff that wants a protective order or the plaintiff that wants a sealing order, they can't get it because that by filing the lawsuit, they waive the right to any relief.
On the basis that you're seeking court relief and court and actual protection of the court at some point, then if you file a plaintiff's action, then you're not allowed to remain.
With regard to disclosure of identity, and the law review articles that I've cited deal with both parties who are plaintiffs who want to proceed under pseudonyms for legitimate reasons, if they can specify what they are, as well as witnesses. And I think even in cases of witnesses, the justification for a sealing order would be even more warranted. And like I say, the law review articles discuss very critically and are very critical of the few courts that have said that if you're going to bring a lawsuit, you've got to take the bad with the good and place yourself in harm's way in order to get into court and litigate your claims. And as I said, the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, in the case I cite, in reversing a U.S. District Court, said that is not the rule, and especially in the context of where an individual or individuals are challenging governmental action, that interest or ability of plaintiffs to do so outweighs any interest the public may have. Of course, opposing counsel, we haven't ever had a hearing about, because we didn't have a permanent or a hearing on a permanent order. The public interest were never entered into the court's consideration of the matter in this case, because it was a temporary order where the public would not have gotten notice or been present. It was just basically them saying, it's the end of the world if we can't tell everybody in the world who these people are, and if their names get in the paper, or if some just jockey on a radio station in Dallas wants to broadcast all day long about who they are and what their address is and how they're causing problems or being uppity, I think was the word I used in the hearing.
The last thing I'd like to ask you, and I see your time's up, but I still want to ask you this question.
Okay.
The witnesses you're talking about.
Right.
Without identifying any of them, is it a clear fact that all of them have been convicted and have been required to be required to file registration as a sex offender?
There is absolutely no doubt. That's what we allege, and we can provide in the affidavits. Basically, how it would work is if we respond to this plea of jurisdiction with affidavits, we would be using pseudonyms, and they would be swearing under oath. We could provide unredacted or non-synonymous affidavits to opposing side. And what we did in Travis County was we just agreed on initials for each of these individual witnesses. And so they knew who they were. I knew who they were. I could file the response with the court, and you never needed a sealing order because the clerk wouldn't know who you're talking about. And the court said they didn't care who you're talking about. But if you had affidavits, they could assume that they were real people because opposing counsel would be objecting otherwise. So this isn't a problem with them not being able to litigate the standing issue. It's a problem of them using the rule as a sword, not a shield, to give me a Hobsonian choice of either dismissing my claims that can't be supported by registrants who don't want to place themselves in harm or apprehension of harm, or talking them into agreeing to that risk, which has not been. There's a couple that are kind of on the fence, but some of them just say, I've got family, I've got kids, I don't want to see my name on the news, I don't want to see my name in this community newspaper, and things like that. So does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you for answering the question.
I appreciate it. I'm sorry for going over.
Well, that's because I asked you the question. It wasn't your fault.
Thank you, Mr. Gladden. If you would please add 1 minute.
May it please the court. The trial court did err in this case, but the trial court's error had absolutely nothing to do with Plaintiff Texas Voice's failed and butchered efforts to seek a protective order that would allow it to proceed with unidentified or anonymous plaintiffs or witnesses. Instead, the trial court's error in this case was its failure or refusal to take up, consider, and rule on the city's pleas to the jurisdiction that had been timely filed as mandated by the Supreme Court in Texas Department of Parks and Wildlife versus Miranda, 133 Southwest 3rd, 217. The cities, each of the four cities, timely filed their pleas to the jurisdiction and did urge them. We urged them at the hearing on plaintiff's motion for protective order, and we also urged them 10 days later on an actual hearing on the pleas to the jurisdiction. And it's unfortunate that we never got even a ruling on the defendant's pleas to the jurisdiction. But a review of plaintiff's pleadings and the status of this case reveals that plaintiff has absolutely failed to meet its burden to establish the jurisdiction of either the trial court or of this court, because it hasn't met either of the two parts of the two-part test to establish a waiver of the city's immunity.
Counsel, I'd like to hear, before you discuss that, I'd like to hear you join issue with the temporary sealing argument, please.
Yes, Your Honor. The issue on the first thing I'd like to point out relative to the motion to seal is that the standard of review that's before us today is an abuse of discretion standard. And I want to just walk this panel briefly through the procedural history on how we got to that hearing on the motion of protection on February 5th, because on page 2 of appellant's brief, they cite either mistakenly or disingenuously, and they say that on January 22nd, plaintiff filed a motion to seal evidentiary documents and for a protective order under Rule 76A5. But a thorough review of that January 22nd pleading doesn't reveal any citation or any reference whatsoever to Rule 76. I bring this up to point out that later on at the hearing on February 5th, the day of that hearing, plaintiff filed a responsive pleading that makes reference to Rule 76A5, and the reason they did so is because they couldn't proceed based on their original pleading, because their original pleading cited Rule 192.6, and what Rule 192.6 says at the end of it, it says motions for protection under this rule must follow the provisions of 76A. And at that point, even though it had been the 14 days, so there had been time to file the notice required by 76A3, they hadn't done it, so they were in a quandary here. So now, in a revisionist history sort of posture, they've said, well, actually,
we did... Initial motion seek sealing?
It was a motion for protection based on Rule 192.6. We have two fundamental issues with that particular issue, though, and this gets down to sort of the confusion on the questions at the end of opposing counsel's argument, and that has to do with the different treatment of plaintiff versus defendant. Here, there's never been an argument by the defendant cities that plaintiffs and defendants should be treated differently, but the text of Rule 192.6 is clear. Rule 192.6A says it applies to and I'm going to quote this, a person from whom discovery is sought. And what the trial court...
But my question was, did the motion seek sealing? Despite what rule it referenced?
The original motion was somewhat confusing in what it was seeking, Justice Walker.
Well, if the motion prayed for sealing, the only sealing rule in existence is Rule 76A.
I believe that the relief that's been sought includes the request for sealing. And when you get to Rule 76A, and we'll quickly move on to that because that's really the relevant rule, because they never met the procedural requirements of 192.6, and to the extent they had been seeking or were seeking sealing, 192.6A is not applicable. I want to get back to the abuse of discretion. And in preparing for today's argument, I reviewed the court's transcript from the hearing on the motion to motion for protection, and I would point the panel to pages 55 and 56 of that transcript, where at the end of a hearing, an evidentiary hearing, by the way, that was held over the defendant city's objections because they wanted their pleas to the jurisdiction heard first.
The trial court have the right to control the order of the proceedings in the cause? I mean, isn't it totally up to the trial court if it wants to hear the sealing motion before the plea to the jurisdiction?
Justice Walker, our position is consistently that the Supreme Court mandate in the Miranda case is that once a plea to the jurisdiction has been filed, that should be the first thing undertaken by the trial court.
But discovery can even be taken in connection with a plea to the jurisdiction.
In some circumstances, Your Honor, but that's not what we're dealing with here. Here we were talking about a motion for protection that was originally filed under 192.6 and was subsequently converted to a motion based on 76A5. And relative to that motion that was then converted to 76A5, the standard of review here is an abuse of discretion standard. And the test under that standard is whether or not the trial court acted without reference to guiding rules or principles or acted in an arbitrary or unreasonable manner. The standard under Rule 76A5 that plaintiff failed to meet is that they must prove to the trial court that there is a threat of, and this is the actual text of the rule, threat of immediate and irreparable harm. That's the text of the rule, and that claim must be supported either by an affidavit or a verified pleading. Here, the only evidence before the trial court that could have met that standard of submission under 76A5 is an affidavit by plaintiff's counsel. Plaintiff's counsel is, for purposes of Rule 76A5, then, the only applicant. The problem is that affidavit doesn't testify or assert any allegation of a threat of immediate and irreparable harm to the actual applicant, because the applicant in that case, based on how Rule 76A5 applies, was Mr. Gladden. Mr. Gladden cannot stand, based on Rule 76A5, to support, to meet that standard, and even if you, just for purposes of argument, presumed that he must be able to speak on behalf of his clients based on Rule 76A5, that standard still hasn't been met to the point that the trial court's determination that motion should...
How is the party, not the applicant?
Rule 76A5 says the facts must be submitted or shown by affidavit or verified petition related to the specific interest of the applicant.
Correct. So wouldn't the applicant be the party to the suit? Wouldn't the applicant be Voices of Reason or whatever the acronym is? Texas Voices for Reason and Justice?
The evidence that should be submitted should have been submitted by an actual party or a party witness. What's really at issue here is that Texas Voices is attempting to avoid the disclosure of the identity of their plaintiff witnesses when there's absolutely no support for that under the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure. If you look and say, how do I proceed in state civil court with anonymous or undisclosed witnesses, then there's no provision for that in Texas state civil court. And so this is effectively an end-around effort to do that. And when we look at the trial court's consideration of this, the trial court did cite to the correct and applicable rule, as you can see on pages 55 and 56 of the reporter's record, Rule 76A5. He did apply the applicable standard, which is whether or not the applicant had shown and proven that there was a genuine threat of immediate and irreparable harm, and based on the absence of that, overruled and denied the motion. When we're talking about the plaintiffs and what their identity is, it's important to the first issue that I was talking about, and that is jurisdiction. Just like in the case that's going to follow us, standing is an important issue in this case, and it's a jurisdictional issue in this case. And as Mr. Gladden correctly noted, they are attempting to proceed based on associational standing. And in order to establish associational standard, there's two requirements that this party has not and cannot meet, even if you were to remand this back to the trial court. First is that entity, the plaintiff.
Aren't you getting way ahead of the issue? The only issue on appeal here today is the appellant's issue that the court abused its discretion in denying the motion for temporary sealing. And you're jumping ahead to the plea to the jurisdiction and associational standing. You're not the appellant in this case. They are. So aren't you getting ahead of the issue?
We take the position, Justice Gabriel, that the obligation to have established subject matter jurisdiction applies in both the trial court and in the Court of Appeals, and can be raised for the first time at the Court of Appeals. That notwithstanding, relative to the motion to for a protective order under Rule 76A5, we assert that there's absolutely no question that the trial court did not abuse his discretion when considering that particular motion. The court cited the applicable rule, followed through the evidentiary tests and the statutory standard under Rule 76A5, and looked at whether or not there was a threat of immediate and irreparable harm. And there is no evidence that can meet that standard. And here, the standard of review is not de novo. It's an abuse of discretion standard. And we assert that the trial court absolutely did not abuse its discretion relative to its denial of that particular motion. Thank you.
Thank you.
In response to the defendant's or appellee's last few statements, Justice Gabriel, I think you're correct. There has not been a ruling on the pleaded jurisdiction, and in order to kind of understand kind of the context in which this appeal comes to you, I would refer briefly to the rules on pleaded jurisdiction, not to bring up that issue for consideration by this court, but to understand the urgency and as the court acknowledges, the time frame that caused me to have to file it without having the 14 days notice before seeking a permanent order. On pleas to jurisdiction under Texas Parks and Wildlife versus Miranda and its progeny, the Texas Supreme Court has said you've got basically two kinds. You've got one kind that's more or less what in the federal system you'd call a challenge for failure to state a claim, where you're limited to just whether the allegations taken as true do or do not state a claim. The same thing would apply if the opposing or the defendant raised a question of standing. Only if the person, the defendant in a civil lawsuit, presents or submits evidence to raise a fact issue on the question of standing or anything else that might be raised in pleaded jurisdiction, does it become incumbent upon the plaintiff to respond to that with affidavits, testimony, or whatever else that's evidentiary to either create or fail to create a genuine issue. In this case, the pleas to jurisdiction, there were four of them, at least one of them, and probably more than one of them, raised the question of whether there's an evidentiary basis, and they submitted some kind of assertions at least. There's kind of an exception to the question of whether they've got to submit evidence in order to shift the burden to me to present evidence, one of which is if there's a sham, if somebody's claiming something that it's just kind of a sham thing. They did more or less make an allegation that there was nobody, we didn't have any members, or we didn't have any members that fit the description and the allegations that we made. And for that reason, I realized it was necessary for me to get affidavits from my registrant witnesses on behalf of whom the organization is suing on under the associational standing doctrine. And that was the reason why I immediately then requested this protection as ancillary relief to a sealing order. The hearing did not just involve an affidavit or submission, although we did submit affidavits in support of our request for a sealing order. We also presented two live witnesses. The defendants did not present anything other than we're not going to be able to litigate the standing question unless we can disclose to other people who these witnesses are. And like I say, I think that the ultimate resolution of the matter by the district court, and if you look at the quote that I have on page 21 of my brief, the court was clear. It said in the first 30 seconds, we all understood, I think, that we're proceeding under Rule 76A, Section 5. And so there wasn't any kind of claim defect in my motion, I think, is kind of moot, since it was apparent to the court when it ruled what the issue was. And
I have a question, because you say that the trial court denied your motion because you're the plaintiff and you can't come in and ask for what you're asking for. They say the trial court denied your motion because you didn't have any evidence of immediate or irreparable injury. Do you agree that that was a basis of the trial court's denial?
No.
And second, what is your evidence of immediate and irreparable injury?
Okay. Number one, the passage that I set out on page 21, where the court says, you're not being compelled in order to provide a defense mechanism to a lawsuit that someone else brought. I understand that you're saying this is a defense to a plea of jurisdiction, but in fact, you guys are, are the plaintiffs in this particular case proceeding under 76A5, and therefore I'm limited. And basically, he kind of puts it off on us since we're the plaintiffs and we should have thought about trying to get relief under 76A before we filed the lawsuit, because the result would be we're not entitled to relief kind of under this waiver justification. Now, as far as the imminent threat, there's two different kinds that I talk about in my brief. One is we are suing under associational standing on behalf of these witnesses who are registrants. And we're not claiming that this was in response to a discovery request, because no discovery had been served on us by opposing counsel. But we did cite that rule and discuss that rule by way of guidelines on what kind of relief should be granted as ancillary to the sealing order.
But he said your only evidence was your affidavit.
No. No, we had two witnesses testify. And quite frankly, I think I can submit an affidavit. And I believe there's probably other affidavits in there, but it wasn't just affidavits that the trial court heard. It also heard from a registrant who said, I think I recall his testimony being he was threatened with being thrown off a roof when his coworkers found out that he was a registrant. And ever since that time, and probably before that time, of course, he had to start registering when he was 12 years old because he allegedly, I think, probably pled guilty to improperly touching his sister, who was a couple of 2 or 3 years younger. Is a 35-year-old man who I think is still required to register. We also had a former counselor who testified that it came up constantly, that there's a constant fear of people required to register, that not just from being on the registry, but just the fact that they're out living in the community, they're treated differently, their children are treated differently, their spouses are treated differently. And then, of course, I do cite what's kind of a judicial finding of two federal courts of appeals based upon an amicus brief that was filed in the Smith versus Doe in the U.S. Supreme Court describing at length, and that actual amicus brief is available through Westlaw if you want to read it, and the numerous incidences where people have been, who are registrants, live under and are often actually subjected to physical harm and vandalism and destruction of their property. So I submit to you that the real reason the trial court denied this was based upon this quotation is the plaintiff waiver rule that I discussed elsewhere in my brief as discussed in these law review articles. Thank you.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for your arguments here today. They've been very helpful to the court. We appreciate you coming down and presenting them. Your case is submitted.